Good afternoon. I'm Mike Nichols with NBA. That was loud, wasn't it? It's my pleasure to welcome you to the afternoon educational session on prevention of infectious disease in aviation and pandemic preparedness. So with the TB scare of the last week or so, I think that this is a really timely topic that we planned last fall. So we had a lot of foresight into the future. So if you'd like the lottery numbers for next week, let me know and I'll give them to you. I just won't tell you which lottery it's for. I hope everybody's having a really good time visiting with exhibitors and seeing the aircraft on static display. Another important component to the regional forums obviously is the educational sessions that we provide. And I think that this topic is an important topic, a good topic for flight departments, charter operations, and just general consumers to be aware of. And I'm pleased that Patty Campbell, who has national certification in critical care and is a nurse practitioner, who has spent more than two decades as a leader in aviation and emergency response industries as a practicing emergency nurse practitioner, flight nurse, author, and consultant. She's the co-author of the Manual of In-Flight Medical Care, and she works as a nurse practitioner at Good Samaritan Medical Center in Phoenix, and that's a level one trauma center, and they're also the home to MedLink Center. And she is also an educational consultant for MedAir, and it's in that capacity she's come to speak with us today. So, Patty, thank you.
Welcome to all of you. Thanks for having me again. I've had the pleasure of speaking at NBAA in the past, and I always enjoy being with my aviation colleagues. It's nice to have you all here. I'm sorry that my slot is right after lunch, and I'm sure that you guys are going to be off to sleep, but we'll try to keep you engaged and interested in this topic. For those of you who are kind of slight of stomach, I'm sorry we have to talk about these things right after lunch, but hopefully it won't be too gruesome for you. I tend to like to walk around when I talk, so can I use this mic? Okay. Can you guys hear me at all? Well, you know, I'll just stay here then. That's fine. Can you talk? Okay. Can you all hear me? Okay, great. What they asked me to talk about today is infectious disease in aviation and pandemic preparedness for aviation. This is a huge topic, something that is difficult to cover in 1 hour that we have. And I actually have taken out some slides on pandemic preparedness because of the latest news releases that we had about tuberculosis the past couple weeks. We've been getting a lot of calls and questions about TB in aviation and what should we be concerned about. So if you bear with me, at the end of the presentation, I do have some slides specific to TB that we can talk about. And then during the QA session, I'll be happy to answer any of your questions if I can. When we're talking about infectious disease, it's really a major concern in aviation and in the world as we know it. The pandemic clock is ticking. We just don't know what time it is. And this was said by the co-director, co-author of the influenza pandemic plan that Department of Health Services here in the United States. We know from history that we typically have three pandemics a century, and it's just inevitable. We're going to have it. And unfortunately, everybody gets excited about it when it's in the news, and we hear a lot about it, and the news, the drive-by news media picks it up, and we all get all excited about it. And then it doesn't happen in the next month or so, and we all kind of put it on the back burner, and we figure it's not going to happen. Well, I'm here to tell you that it is going to happen. We just don't know what organism is going to cause it, and we don't know when it's going to occur. But it would benefit all of us to keep it in our minds and keep it in our planning, both from a business perspective and from a personal perspective. There's a lot of terms that are thrown out in the media, and I want to just kind of explain them to you. Epidemic and pandemic. There's a difference. Epidemics occur when you have a disease outbreak, like measles or chickenpox or some disease that we as humans have seen. Our immune systems have seen it before, so we have some immunity in the population. So there's going to be some people who get it and some people who are pretty much immune to it. But it's a disease that is a human disease that we as a human race have seen in the past. A pandemic is very different. This is an organism that is new. You'll hear in the media, they'll say something like an emerging disease. It means that it's emerging out of the, usually it's coming out of the animal population into the human sector, and it's a disease that none of the human population's immune system has ever seen before. Examples of that are SARS. We had never seen that in the human race before. And the other example that we're seeing right now is the H5N1 avian or bird flu that's prevalent over in China. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that. If you look back in history, the pandemics that occurred during the last century occurred in 1918, 1919 is the famous Spanish flu. During that time, we had 40 million deaths worldwide. 500,000 of those were in the United States. There were several disease waves, so they didn't just happen and it went away. And that's what happens with pandemics. You get a first wave, and then you get a second wave. And you can see this by the chart at the left side. Half of the deaths were in young, healthy people. And we're seeing that with the H5N1 virus over in Asia. It's not the really, really young, it's not the children, and it's not the elderly that are dying from these pandemic-like diseases. It is really the young, healthy adults. And you say, well, Patty, why is that? Why would the 20-year-olds, the teenagers, the 20 and 30-year-olds be the ones who are dying from this? The reason is that their immune systems are so intact and they are so hyper-responsive that it actually works against them in certain diseases. So that's kind of why we see a large amount of our population in pandemics die in that most productive age group. In 1957-58, we had the Asian flu. Now, most of you are too young in here to remember that. We had 70,000 deaths in the U.S. and 2 million worldwide. And then the last one that we had was 68-69. Again, most of you in here were just being thought of at that time and weren't around. But I happen to remember it. And we had 34,000 deaths in the U.S. and 700,000 worldwide. Now, compare the last pandemic that we had, 34,000 deaths. How many deaths do you think that we have every year just with seasonal flu, just with our garden variety of flu? How many deaths do you think we have in the United States? We have about 28,000 deaths a year just from our seasonal winter flu that we have here. So that's pretty significant. Now, most of the people that succumb to the flu here in the United States now are what? They're the elderly and the young. Because it's not a pandemic flu, it's a flu that circulates throughout the season. The World Health Organization has a concern right now for pandemics. The H5N1 virus, which is the bird flu over in Asia, is the one that they are keenly keeping track of. It is not a human virus, and I want to emphasize that. It has not developed into a human virus. It cannot be spread from human to human. It's only had about 3 cases where it actually was transmitted from a sick child to a mother because of very, very close contact. But it has not mutated into a human virus where it can be spread easily like our garden variety flu that we have every year. Infections in birds are a concern. Because now it's endemic in bird populations, not only in poultry and in domestic fowl, but also in wild bird populations. And this is of concern for corporate aviation. And the reason is because if you're flying over Asia in your corporate jet and you happen to run into a flock of birds that are ill with H5N1, and you know what a mess it is. Have any of you experienced bird strikes in your aircraft? You know what a mess it is. Think about that, cleaning it up, and later in the presentation, the CDC actually has guidelines for how you need to clean your aircraft so that you don't get exposed to the virus, okay? The H5N1 virus, as I said, is not yet a human virus. The people that are getting H5N1 over in Asia are getting it from exposure to infected birds. They're not getting it from human to human. It's because they're being exposed to infections from the bird population. This is the latest statistics this morning from the World Health Organization. There's been a total of 310 cases of human H5N1 flu, and there's been 189 deaths. Now, if you do the math on that, it's approximately a 61% death rate. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't think I would want to be exposed to an illness that had a 61 or 60% death rate. Okay. The potential risks for an avian influenza are substantial. And when our health experts look at the United States and what a pandemic would mean for us here in the United States, this is what a moderate to severe attack would be for us. We're looking at a 30 to 40% attack rate, meaning that's how many people in our population would initially get sick. Now, you think about running your business with 40% of your people gone or sick. Think about how you're going to deal with your home life. How are you going to get your food? If 40% of the truckers who are trucking the food across the United States are sick, your grocery store shelves are going to be empty. What about the healthcare providers who are actually taking care of ill people? They are going to be down 40%. You're not going to be able to rely on going to hospital ERs. We're in crisis mode already. So this is why when you go on the websites that I give you at the end of the presentation, it's so important for you all to plan as a company and also personally, because everybody's going to have to do planning individually for this crisis. Health and power and food and water supplies, all of these. We have meetings weekly looking at when we're doing disaster planning. How are we going to keep the lights on if 40% of the people who are running your power plants and your nuclear power plants are off sick? How are we going to keep those services that keep our society running and safe going if we are dealing with that kind of population reduction? Communication systems failures. What about restricted travel? For those of you who do scheduling for your corporate jets, what happens when a pandemic occurs and you have crews that are overseas and the recommendations are you're not coming back to the U.S., you're sheltering in place? Does your company have a plan to make sure that those employees are taken care of and that they are going to get the health care that they need and also have the resources available to them if they can't make it home? Okay? Aviation has a key role in the spread or prevention of a pandemic. And I say that because travel patterns have dramatically increased since our last pandemic. And in a couple slides, I'm going to show you what I mean about that. The problem is we have a spread of novel viruses coming from Asia. 100 years ago, it took forever. They had to come over on a boat. Now they're coming over in 24 hours. And you get a patient or a person coming into San Francisco with a novel virus that none of us have ever seen before, and it just goes through the community. Those things are what we are trying to deal with. The CDC and the World Health Organization are trying to get their arms around how to prevent this. But we have a role also in aviation, and we'll talk about some of the things that we can do as aviators as I go through. This is the major migration flows in the 1960 to 1975. This is the world patterns of travel back then. Compare that to the 1990s, and I have not found a new one yet, but this is over 17 years old. So you can imagine what that diagram would look like today. And that is why it is so vital that we really step up to the plate and try to prevent diseases from coming into the United States. Let me share with you what the CDC does when a novel virus happens. This is what happened when SARS occurred. You all remember SARS 2002? What happened was the CDC has a whole team of investigators that when a novel virus or an infectious disease comes into the United States, their sole job is to research that source of infection back to the root, and they will find them. So think about that when you are trying to bring someone back into the country that may be sick with a novel virus, the CDC will find out who that is, and I don't think you want to be on the front page of the paper. But this is an example of how the CDC will do their investigation. There was a physician that was working in a clinic in Guangdong province in China. He was exposed to a patient that had SARS. SARS didn't even have a name back then. We didn't even know what SARS was. He then travels to Hong Kong, stays in a hotel in Hong Kong, and just by being in that hotel, getting into an elevator, coughing, sneezing, on handrails, on buttons, whatever he was exposed to, he exposed all these other people in the second layer here. So somehow they picked up the SARS virus. So if you can see at the top, F and G, those are two individual people that somehow contracted the SARS virus, and they went back to Canada. And then they infected 18 healthcare workers there. Then we have K, who went to Ireland. Then we have I, L, and M, three more people, who went to the United States. And one healthcare worker was infected. This was early on. We actually had more. Then you had C, D, and E, who were also staying at that hotel. And they went to Singapore and infected 34 healthcare workers and 37 close contacts. Then B went to Vietnam, and they exposed 37 healthcare workers and 21 close contacts. And then the original doctor went to Hong Kong along with H&J, and they all exposed 95 people with over 100 close contacts. So this is how the CDC works, and they find out who is the source of infection, who were they contacted with, and what they need to do. So I think that's very enlightening as to what kind of research they do and investigation. The research from the 1918 pandemic shows significant reduction in deaths if we do some very simple things early on. Not relying on antiviral medications because there won't be enough. Not relying on not relying on vaccines because they won't be available initially in a pandemic. And by the way, did you all see last month the news release, the FDA has approved a new H5N1 vaccine for the United States, and they're manufacturing it. However, the government has bought every single dose, so it's in the national stockpile. And if you're interested in who's going to be getting the vaccines, all you have to do is go on the website, the government website, the CDC website, and you can find your nation's protocol for pandemic and who will be getting the vaccines initially. And I'm here to tell you it's not the general public. It's going to be the police, the law enforcement, the fire departments, the power people, the people that need to keep our society going are the ones that are going to be vaccinating first. Okay? So it's up to us to protect ourselves. And so the CDC has come out with a whole plan on how we can do that very simply. And it has to do with non-pharmacologic prevention. That means social distancing. What do I mean by social distancing? Well, it means not going out in public, closing schools, closing football fields, closing shopping centers, essentially closing down churches, all of those things where you have large numbers of people gathered together. Those will be restricted if a pandemic starts to occur. School closures, travel restrictions, all of those are things that we will start to see. This is a slide that shows what a huge difference community prevention strategies can make. If you close schools, if you close shopping centers, if you wash your hands, if you don't go out if you're sick, if you don't go to work when you're sick and coughing, this shows how we can delay the onset of a pandemic, okay? So the daily cases, and this is the days since the first case. So say the pandemic flu comes to the United States. This would be the first couple cases here. And then we see a huge surge. This is with nobody closing schools, nobody closing businesses, no one washing their hands, no travel restrictions. You can see that we have a huge surge in the number of cases and a huge death rate because of that. It also, this won't be the first wave, because remember what I told you, there's going to be second and third waves as well. This is the first wave. But if we all work together as a community and you wash your hands and you do cough etiquette where you cover your mouth when you're coughing and you don't go to work sick, you don't let your kids go to school sick, then what happens is that curve becomes lengthened out here and it gives us less cases and more time to develop that life-saving vaccine when that next wave comes. So you'll be hearing a lot about that. The CDC is really putting out a lot of public information about social distancing and cough etiquette and washing your hands. And that's why, because it's critical in preventing disease. So what can we do in the aviation world? Now that you have this background and this wealth of information, what can we do to prevent the spread of a pandemic flu, and you can apply this to any infectious disease, even the garden variety flu that we all get plagued with every year. The first thing is training your flight attendants, your cabin crew, your flight deck crew, according to the National Policy and Plan for Aviation. And I'm going to give you that resource at the end. There's a whole new manual about aviation and infectious disease that you can download on the internet, and so I will give you that resource at the end of the presentation. Early identification of ill passengers, critical. Who's ill? If you have someone that has a fever and is coughing, it's essential that you take that information and you do something with it, and we're going to talk about what you need to do with that in a minute. Isolation. If you see somebody who is coughing, try to get them to the back of the aircraft, move your other passengers up front, try to do some social distancing from them. And then, of course, reporting passengers according to 42 CFR Section 7121B. Have you all ever heard of that regulation? Okay, here it is. This is a federal law, okay? The captain of an aircraft destined for a U.S. port is required to report to the nearest port authority and quarantine station any passengers or crew that have these symptoms. What's required for reporting is the top. If you have a death on board, if you have a fever of 100 degrees for two or more days, if you have a fever of any duration and they have a rash, they have swelling of their neck glands, if they have jaundice, and jaundice is when you look like an orange pumpkin when you have liver disease, you look kind of yellow and orange, or if you have severe diarrhea, these are required by federal law to be reported to the port authority, okay? Now, this was just revised in the last 6 months, and I work very closely with the CDC, and I've asked them, why did they revise this into a required and requested? It's because they don't want you guys to get fatigued with reporting, but they also want to capture only those really dangerous diseases. So they would like it if you would report anybody that has difficulty breathing, a headache with a stiff neck, if they have an altered level of consciousness, if they're crazier than they usually are, is what that means, or any unexplained bleeding. If they have any of those four things with a fever, then the CDC wants you to notify them. The CDC on their website has a new guideline that just was published in the last couple months, and here it is on the left. You can download this right from their website. And it's notifying the public health authorities of ill passengers or crew on flights arriving in the United States. So it's everything that flight attendants need to do. Now, I agree, this is basically geared towards commercial aviation, but it is also required of corporate aviation. It's just that CDC has been focusing so much on commercial because that's where the majority of people are coming from. But corporate aviation is key because we don't go through all of the screening processes in corporate aviation that they do in commercial. So it's very easy that someone could come from Asia, have an infection, and bring it into the United States. So it's paramount that our pilots in corporate aviation know what is required of them. I won't read all this off, but you can download this for your flight attendants on your for your crews. Now, the other thing I want you to keep in mind, how many of you are just say, well, Patty, I just fly domestic. I don't fly overseas. But I bet you fly to LA, to San Francisco, to New York, and you're picking up people that have flown commercial from overseas. and you're putting them on your plane. So think about that. You know, just because you're not making the trip overseas, you're picking up somebody who not only just flew over, but has been exposed to how many hundreds of people on that flight coming in from overseas. So it's essential that we train our flight attendants in corporate aviation so that they are aware of this, ask the right questions, and think about evaluating their passengers. This is the new National Aviation Resource Manual for Quarantinable Diseases. And again, this is downloadable on the website. You can get it through CDC. Okay, it's free. You can download the whole thing and put it on your bookshelf. But I would encourage you to use it for your training. It talks about the role of the FAA, the CDC, the Department of Health, and the airlines. All of them went together to put this manuscript together. It'll tell you all you want to ever know about communicable diseases, about how the airports are going to respond, and what you can expect once you report an illness to the port authorities. You can also, for those of you who are clients in MedLink, you can also call MedLink. Our MedLink physicians are very versed in what is reportable and what is not. So we really try to help out our captains on our aircraft, because we recognize that you have plenty of other things to think about in just flying that aircraft. So just per usual protocol, you call MedLink if you have a passenger, and you don't know if it's a reportable disease or not, we will take care of it, okay? So you call MedLink, we'll help you take care of the passenger. We will advise you if it's a CDC reportable illness. And right now, the letter of the law is the captain is the one, the sole person who has to make that call. However, the CDC has worked with us so much, they are willing to have our doctors make a call for you, or at least assist you in making that call. And we will be able to provide you with all the other resources as well. These are the quarantine stations that are currently up and going in the United States. Just because you call in an infectious disease does not mean you're going to be routed to El Paso or East Texas or Houston. What it does mean, if you make the call and you have a person who has a reportable symptoms, they will often notify the local health departments, who then will work in conjunction with the CDC. They will come on, they'll evaluate the passenger, they'll get the emergency medical services, and they'll get them, you know, taken care of and off to a hospital as soon as possible. It doesn't mean that your aircraft is going to be in lockdown for 30 days, okay? So there's a quarantine. When we think about the old-time quarantine, is very different now. The quarantine stations actually are designed to protect us, the public, from diseases coming into the country. And if necessary, isolating infected or ill passengers. That's their job, and that's what they do to protect us. They will provide the medical evaluation, and they will also provide information to any other infected passengers on your aircraft. So, for example, if you're bringing someone from the Middle East who has symptoms of meningitis, they have a headache and they have a fever, and you have six other passengers on your flight, and you've just flown for 10 hours or 12 hours, those passengers have a right to know what kind of illness they can expect, what can we do to prevent the illness, and they will need to have medical evaluation as well. So all those resources are done by the CDC and the health departments. Let's talk a little bit about the difference between isolation and quarantine, because these words, when they're used in the drive-by media, tend to be scary sometimes. Isolation is simply isolating or removing a sick person from the rest of the population. We do this all the time in the hospital. You come in and a kid has measles, because I'm from Arizona, and we have a lot of measles every year because we have a lot of immigrants from countries that are not being vaccinated. So we have to deal with measles every year. Those kids go into isolation so that you gown and glove and mask every time you go in to see the patient. And it's done to protect the rest of us from developing that disease. Quarantine, on the other hand, is isolating or separating people who are well but have been exposed. So if you're in an aircraft with someone who's sick, you've been exposed, but you're not yourself sick. So quarantine just means you need to be aware of what signs and symptoms of the disease that you were exposed to, what you need to look for. If it's a very serious disease, like extremely drug-resistant TB, then you might be asked to stay at home for a certain period of time, or the health department would tell you that. It's not that they're going to lock you up, although that can happen, and they have the right under federal law to do that if you do not comply with the health department's guidelines. And we have a case right now in Phoenix, Arizona, of a gentleman who immigrated from Russia, and it's all over the news, so I'm not divulging any patient confidentiality. He immigrated from Russia, where they have extremely drug-resistant TB and multi-drug-resistant TB. He was told not to go out in public without wearing a mask. He repeatedly disobeyed those orders, and he's now in our hospital lockdown ward in Phoenix, Arizona, and is in isolation there because he is court-ordered not to be able to be a health menace to other people. So, yes, even though the CDC tells you to go home, you need to abide by that for your own protection and for your families. But they do have federal law, and there are legal ramifications if you don't comply. So how can we in business aviation prepare? Flight crew training, I talked a little bit about that. Make sure your flight attendants and your pilots know how and who to contact if there is an ill person on their aircraft. Do your flight attendants know how to manage an ill person? Do they know how to isolate them? Do they know the airflow patterns in your aircraft? Because if you have someone who is coughing, has flu, for example, on your aircraft, you want to park them at the exit flow of your aircraft air system so that it's going out and can go through those HEPA filters. You don't want to park them in an area where the airflow is going to go through the entire aircraft. So it's important that your flight attendants know where and how to take care of those ill passengers. Prevention strategies. How do they use their gloves, their masks, their goggles, everything that they have in their medical kits, their hazardous materials bags, and their sharp containers? Hand washing is key. Are you vigilant about washing your hands? Soap, water, friction, and use paper towels, not the air blowers. Those have shown not to remove as much bacteria or viruses as paper towels do. So use your paper towel, and if you're in the public restroom, use it to open that door and throw it away. Hand gels. How many of you guys use hand gels? You know those little hand gel things? They're excellent. Keep one in your pocket. Keep one up in the cockpit, in the flight deck, in the galley. Use them all the time. We all know it's very difficult to wash your hands on an aircraft. Running water is sometimes not at its best, but if you can't use the running water, if you can't wash your hands, then use the hand gels. Surface cleaners. How often does your aircraft get cleaned? What about the flight deck? What about the controls in the flight deck? How often are those cleaned? If you have a pilot who's up there sniffling, he's rubbing his nose because it's running, and he's coughing and sneezing all over the controls, what do you think happens to the next person that comes up there and is now touching all the buttons and in there? You're going to get exposed. So those are the kinds of things that you need to be aware of. Also, the way that you clean your aircraft, the aerosolized blowers that they do, all that does is aerosolize those germs up in the air so you inhale them. So you need to be careful in how you're cleaning your aircraft. I love this slide. Luckily, we've been 30 minutes now since lunch. This is a slide from the CDC, and it shows when someone sneezes or coughs without covering their mouth, look at all of the fomites that come out of their mouth, viruses, bacteria. If you're standing there when someone sneezes in front of you, look what you're inhaling. You guys will never forget this picture, I know. This is when you just have a normal mask on. And this is the same person coughing and sneezing with a mask on. This is why the CDC says if you have a passenger on your aircraft that is coughing and sneezing, put a mask on them, because look at how it limits the amount of viruses that the rest of you are going to be exposed to. And in fact, just May 5th, couple weeks ago, the CDC came out with general public use for a mask, just a simple mask, or a respirator like an N95 mask. Never before have we had guidelines out for the general public to use these pieces of equipment, but they are out there now in preparation for when we ever have a pandemic. And the general guidelines are, for surgical masks, just the little masks that we use all the time in surgery and in the ER, for those, if you're ill, a surgical mask is meant for someone who's ill. So if I'm ill, I'm going to put a surgical mask on, because remember that picture? When I cough, it's going to limit me exposing you. But if I'm a person that's well and I'm taking care of my family member who is sick, then an N95 mask is going to be for me to wear because I'm well and I don't want to inhale all those things that you saw in that previous picture. Okay? So the N95 mask is only if you're caring for someone who is very ill at home, okay, and has a respiratory illness like TB, like the avian flu, like pandemic flu. Okay? Now, remember I talked to you a little bit about the concern about these wild birds that have H5N1. If you're flying overseas over countries that have endemic H5N1 in their bird population and you have a bird strike, this is the kind of mess you have to clean up. And you've got to make sure that you're wearing protective equipment, gown, goggles, mask, gloves, so that you don't get exposed to that virus. The CDC on their website has a complete protocol for maintenance crews on how to clean that up safely, and how to remove their gloves, how to remove their eye protection, everything so that they are not going to be exposed to that. Okay? And it's on www.cdc.gov, and this will all be in your handout, but you can just go to airline crew. They have a whole section on air travel, airlines, and you can go there and find all this information. Okay? Now, I cut this a little bit short. I'm not going to talk today about pandemic planning for your business, but I will tell you it's important that you do that. And the pandemicflu.gov is an excellent website. They have checklists that you can download for your company, for your business, for your personal life, for your church group, for all areas of your life, for your kids' schools. It's a whole checklist on how you can prepare for a pandemic. And I really advise you to go in there, read it, and download that, and start preparing both at home and in your business. Ready.gov is another excellent resource for you. The World Health Organization, WHO.int, they have excellent guidelines as well. And then medair.com also. We update that website for infectious diseases very routinely. So, and then, of course, cdc.gov. Okay, we had a lot of, I want to make sure we have time for questions, so I'm just going to run through a couple slides on tuberculosis, because as you all know, this has really been the hot button over the last couple weeks. Anybody here not know what the issue was with the tuberculosis patient? Everybody's, okay. There are certain strains of tuberculosis that are very drug resistant. We have garden variety tuberculosis, which if you have garden variety tuberculosis, we have a whole cocktail of drugs that we give you for about a year, and presumably then you are treated and hopefully cured. The problem is that in other countries, there was a limit to the amount of medications available in their prisons and in their hospitals, and what happened was they were treating tuberculosis patients with maybe a month worth of medication, and then they ran out of money. And then they'd give another group of them a month's worth, and they'd kind of just spread it around. Well, what happened was those TB bugs, those organisms, developed resistance. And so now we have a multi-drug resistant form of TB that will not respond to the medications, both frontline and second line, that we have, and it's extremely dangerous. So just a side note, when your doctor puts you on an antibiotic and says, even though you're feeling well, take the whole thing, that's why. That's exactly why. Because if you don't, that bug in you is going to develop resistance to that medication, and then we won't be able to use it anymore. And we have a huge problem with that in the United States right now and worldwide. Anyway, with tuberculosis, we have garden variety TB, then we have the multi-drug resistant, which is MDR, and then we have a next step of that, which is the extreme drug resistant TB. This one is not responsive to any drugs that we have in our arsenal. None. There are a couple new drugs that are coming out, but it's very, very hard to treat. Oh, so what are the signs and symptoms of TB? Weight loss, fever, night sweats, cough. Sometimes they'll cough up blood if it's a long-term disease. And also TB, although it's inhaled and it starts out as a pulmonary or a lung infection, it can go to any part of your body. So you can have TB of the kidney, you can have TB in all sorts other parts of your body. It's just we usually talk about the TB of the lung. So what is the concern when you hear about someone who's flying on an aircraft, corporate or commercial, who has TB? What are the things that the healthcare providers and the CDC are going to look at to determine if it's a concern or not? There's three different things that we really want to know. Number one, how infectious was that person at the time they were flying? Because if you just have a positive skin test, but you're not coughing and you're not sick, you're really probably not going to pass that on very readily. Whereas if you're coughing and have a fever and you're sick and you have an active TB infection, that is much more of concern. The duration of exposure. TB is not like garden variety flu. It's not like the flu where someone coughs in front of your face and then you have it. You have to have longer exposure. So people that live with people with TB, if you're on a flight where you're with them for over eight hours on a flight, including travel time, ground time and travel time, then your risk of exposure is much greater. And the proximity of you to that person. And that's why I said your flight attendants need to know if someone's coughing and sick, get him away from the other passengers as far as you can on that aircraft instead of just having him sit next to him for 12 hours, okay? These are the countries right now with extremely drug-resistant TB. And for those of you who travel internationally, you can probably see that it's really making its way worldwide. Russia, it has a huge number, as well as China. In the United States, this is the extremely drug-resistant TB that we've had since 1993. Not very many, because we've really tried to keep a handle on it. This is another great document for you that you can download for free on the internet. It's the latest guidelines for air travel and the prevention of TB. It says who can travel with TB and who can't. Okay, and it has everything you'd need to know for flying with TB. Also, MedAir has a round-the-clock travel health watch. We update this for security and for medical problems around the world. And so if you're taking a flight to Chiang Mai, Thailand, you can put that in and you'll get a full up-to-date information for all of the diseases, vaccines, everything that you would need for that travel. So in summary, I just want to let you all know that there are a number, many, many, many infectious diseases out there. Luckily, most of us have very good immune systems. We don't have to worry about them because our bodies take care of it. But we have to be prepared for those novel viruses that are out there that we have never seen before and that we are all susceptible to. So I would just, if you take anything away from this today, it's plan for your families, plan for your businesses, and become educated and make sure that when you're traveling that your flight attendants are trained, your pilots are trained, so that everybody knows how to take care of an incident if it happens on your aircraft. Okay? So I would be happy to answer any questions that you may have. Yes?
If you could use that.
Yeah,
let me
sure
get your microphone.
Ed Smith, Corporate Aviation Systems. We do recurrent training. Most of our people are going to ask, you said in the old days they would quarantine the airplane for 30 days. Well, you know what they're going to ask us. How long are we going to be quarantined? So, I mean, I know when one of the majors that I was at, somebody opened one of the liquor kits and it had dust on it. Flight attendant went cuckoo and thought it was anthrax. Boom. And, you know, they had them out on the ramp hosing them down. This was like 2 in the morning. You know, it got pretty intense. You know, it took all their clothes. Everybody had to wear these orange jumpsuits and this kind of stuff. So that's what's going to happen with our people when they ask us in class, okay, how long is it going to happen, and what can we expect?
Well, that's a great question, and the answer is I don't know. It will depend on what they suspect. If it's any one of those infectious diseases that are reportable, like fever with cough, fever with this, they're not generally going to quarantine your aircraft. You quarantine people, okay? They're not generally going to do that. What they might do is say, we need to isolate your aircraft, get it cleaned according to CDC guidelines, and then have it be okay. In terms of the people, it will depend on the illness. They certainly will, the CDC or the health authority will come on board. They will evaluate the person. They'll probably put them in the ambulance, take them to the hospital, and then we'll decide what to do with them. So that's basically what's going to happen. And I will tell you that all of these, when I was in meetings with the CDC in February, I said, so, you know, how long? I mean, we have visions of these people coming in on commercial jetliners from Asia, one plane after another, coughing and coughing. I mean, I said, I have visions of, like, hangars filled with aircraft and people. And they said, no. They said, what we're going to do is incorporate these initial guidelines to prevent the illness from coming into the United States. Once the illness is here, you know, it's like closing the barn door after the horse is out. These are just initial measures to hopefully delay the spread of that disease into the United States and to lengthen out that bell curve that you saw, okay? But once it's here and once we're all sick, you know, there isn't enough manpower to do that. The whole idea is to prevent it from getting here, and that's where the energy is going to be. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
And when you come to, like, anthrax and those types of things, that would be more in as a terrorist attack, not really just an infectious disease, and that's a whole different animal because then you've got, you know, hazmat teams and that type of thing. So that's a different thing.
Other questions?
I'm just curious about this one with this man named Speaker from.
Yes.
Obviously, these must be all voluntary because he was able to circumvent the whole system. How was he able to get by all this? I'm just curious because they never explain it on the news.
That's a very good question, and forgive me if I speak inappropriate or out of line, but the way that I understand it is that he had, and this is just from CDC reports that I've read that have been sent to healthcare workers, but apparently he had a rib fracture or a chest injury several months ago, had a chest x-ray, and they saw this big lesion on his lung and went, oh. So they start doing tests and sputum tests and all the tests that you do to check for TB. And then apparently was advised not to travel. I guess there's some dispute about that, but he was told by the healthcare providers not to travel. He did decide to travel over to Athens, I believe, to Greece to get married. And then once he was there, they got all the results of his tests and went, oh my goodness. So then the CDC officials overseas went to the hotel to tell him not to travel, and he had already checked out. So apparently, recognizing that he would not be able to fly back into the United States because it comes up on the immigration log, they elected to fly to Canada and then drove through down from Canada. And apparently it did pop up on the border security, and the border guard let him go anyway. And that's, I guess, I've heard he's been removed from his post. And so all of those things are of concern, because certainly even though it was posted, we still have a lot of work to do, apparently, on how to follow through. So that's the story that I understand. Does that answer your question? Okay.
I think we have time for one more question, if there's one. No? Patty, thank you very much. Excellent presentation.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.